Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 76 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Returning today as co-host is Dan Webb. Hi, Dan. Good to have you back.
Hello, Max. Hello, David. Yes, it's great to finally be back and not be in the form of a short MP3 segment. So finally.
Yeah, we missed you. Also co-hosting is our favorite aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Hello, Max. Hello, Dan. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's great to hear you, live and in person.
Absolutely. Aww. Now, Rob Mark is off today. He's nursing the flu. At least that's what he's telling us. So we hope Rob gets well soon and look forward to having him join us next episode. Our guest this episode is James Patton. He is a lifelong test pilot, a very interesting guy. He was recently inducted into the Virginia Aviation Hall of Fame, and we'll be speaking with Jim after we do the news. Coming up, we're also going to have this week's report from the Airplane Geeks Australia desk, and of course, David's This Week in Aviation. But before we do all those things, guys, let's get started with some news. First, from the New York Times, we have FAA clarifies what can be stowed in seatback. This is another piece by Joe Sharkey, and we talked about his previous article on this subject, I think, some time ago, where he had some difficulty with SkyWest telling him that he was not allowed to put any of his personal items in the seatback pocket. Well, apparently the FAA has now issued new guidelines to clarify this situation as to whether passengers can put their own items in the seatback pockets. And it turns out that these pockets are designed to hold around or up to about 3 pounds worth of stuff. And the FAA has come out and said that if you have small, lightweight items, such as eyeglasses or a cell phone, that they can be placed in the seat pocket as long as you don't exceed kind of the total weight for that pocket.
I think the FAA kind of dropped the ball here because it varied on an airline by airline basis, depending on what the FAA told them and who they dealt with at the FAA. So finally, clarity.
SkyWest said that the local FAA office, I guess this is the St. George, Utah office, told them in no uncertain terms that personal items were not allowed. And so the confusion ensued.
Yeah, and I believe there's a conversation. I think I referenced it last time we talked about this subject. There's a topic on Flyer Talk. Apparently, Southwest have been told something similar. So, with the way it was, this is confusing air travelers. So, this is good.
This is good. Now, the FAA is bringing clarity in other areas as well. We have from the DallasNews.com this article: FAA won't allow cockpit naps as part of plan to reduce pilot fatigue. Issues of pilot fatigue have been in the news a lot recently because of several incidents and accidents. And the FAA is working up some regulations, some changes to the regulations, I guess, to address pilot fatigue. And we have in this article that Peggy Gilligan, who is the FAA's Associate Administrator for Aviation Safety, says, quote, "We do believe the crew has come to work prepared for the schedule they are undertaking. We can manage and mitigate their fatigue through the regulations sufficiently that they should be alert throughout that flight and that they're not going to look at naps as a solution to that problem."
Well, maybe it's me, but I'm not allowed to sleep on my job. So I guess if it's a transcontinental flight, I'd almost understand a nap. But a domestic flight in the United States, how long is the longest flight? It's the rest of us have to stay awake, and most of us can't sleep on airplanes anyway. So it seems to me that it should be common sense that the guy controlling a multi-million-dollar piece of machinery at 30,000 feet should be awake and not sound asleep.
Well, I think the plan was to have alternating who was napping. And to tell you the truth, I don't know enough to really judge the idea of the naps, but I mean, at face value, it kind of makes sense. I mean, I'm a power napper myself, but this is obviously an issue that needs to be addressed because I think in some cases, domestic pilots sometimes have it rougher than some international pilots. And obviously, on those international flights, you're required to have multiple pilots and they rotate.
And there it makes sense.
Right, but well, yeah, obviously, but also generally, I believe, if I'm wrong, please correct me, but if you're an international pilot, your layover is going to be a bit longer, maybe some more time to recover, whereas if you're, in some cases, a domestic or regional pilot, you could be running a bit faster for some days in a row. So, I mean, obviously, it's an issue that needs to be addressed, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and we'll have to wait and see what the FAA proposes finally. But one of the aspects that it's going to need to take into account, and it's mentioned in this article, and I think you know David's point sort of touches on it, is that when you look at the time a pilot spends, it's not just the time of the flight of the aircraft he's piloting, but many pilots, as well as flight attendants, commute to work. I mean, I think many people assume that the pilots and the flight attendants must, I don't know, live around the airport or pretty close to it, and they get up and drive their 30 minutes to work and then, you know, begin their workday. And that's just not the case for, you know, many crew. A lot of them have to commute hours on another flight just to get to the point where their job for that day is going to begin. So
Captain Sully, for example, from Flight 1549, lives in California, based in Charlotte.
There you go.
So, I mean, base is close. I mean, and sometimes a pilot doesn't want to move. I mean, if a pilot's family is in a certain city, I mean, that is one that I mean, it's nice to have that freedom, but obviously that's something to be concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's part of the day.
So I'm not sure how that's going to be counted, but I mean, this is an issue that needs to be addressed in some way.
Okay, great. Next, moving along, we have an item from Speed News. And this is 2 years of lost growth, slow improvement trend. This article reports on the International Air Transport Association, the IATA, IATA, and showing the traffic results for October. This is for the month of October that's just out. And it shows that passenger demand was up 0.5% compared to October in 2008, while international cargo was 0.5% below last year's level, but it's a smaller decline than in the previous month, which had been a 5.4% decline. The numbers are kind of interesting. They show international scheduled passenger demand and international scheduled cargo demand. Cargo still being, cargo improving to 14% above the December 2008 low point. And passenger demand is now 6% above the low point that was reached in March 2009.
Yeah, and I think the other stat they used in the report was we're halfway on the passenger side back to January 2008. So,
right.
I mean, it's kind of all this data is saying, you know, we're still bad, but we're slowly getting better. So it's good in the sense that September we started seeing reversal in trend on the downside, and now it's reversed again on the upside. So that's good, at least if you look at the seasonally adjusted data. So this is good. We'll see how it develops. But also, I added did note, quote, yields remain under severe pressure. Although there has been a modest rise in airfare since mid-year, it remains around 20% less expensive to fly in real terms today than it was a year ago, end quote. So premium traffic is showing some improvement. Overall, passenger demand is showing some improvement. But there's still a lot of work to be done. But yes, things are looking better.
Especially in the Middle Eastern area.
Yes.
Look at the numbers passenger demand. Middle Eastern carriers saw a growth in October of over 14%, which is pretty healthy. The others, other regions, you know, kind of ranged from a slight decline to just a small bit of growth. And even in the cargo area, the Mideast carriers see a growth of 18%. Above a month ago.
Yeah, no, the Latin and the markets and the Middle East is doing well. The big question with the Middle East now is what's happening with Emirates now with this whole Dubai debt issue, which is certainly of concern for Boeing and Airbus, especially Airbus when Emirates has 50-something A380s still on order. So Emirates is a big chunk of the Airbus order book right now.
Were you going to say something, David?
No, he jumped right in and answered the question. I was going to ask him about Dubai. See, he's not only is he a boy genius, he's psychic.
Can't ask for more than that.
But yeah, there's the whole question of could something happen with Abu Dhabi here. So there's really not a whole lot of good press reporting here, but we'll have to see what happens. It'll certainly be interesting. Yeah,
bears watching. Another item from Speed News also, two from Speed News this week. This is U.S. Airways pilots ask Department of Justice to investigate U.S. Airways / Delta transaction. And this comes from the U.S. Airline Pilots Association, and they're asking for a full investigation on the impact of the proposed slot, gate, and facility transaction between U.S. Airways and Delta. This is at New York's LaGuardia and Washington's Reagan National Airports.
When I saw this press release, it kind of made me angry at first, because my big question was, if this is such a hugely important issue, why, USAPA, why did you wait until now to release a press release instead of letting everyone know about your opposition back in August when this deal was announced? But whatever, I digress. I had actually a very nice email exchange with a U.S. Airways pilot after he read my blog post. And I see what the pilots are thinking here. And I will concede the point that there is this feeling that perhaps U.S. Airways is getting the short end of the stick, with them giving up, I think, 150 slots to LaGuardia to Delta, and they're only going to, I think, 42 at Reagan National. I would like to note that the press release from the pilots union conveniently neglected to mention that part of the deal involves U.S. Airways getting rights to fly to Tokyo and Sao Paulo in Brazil.
Yeah.
But I will understand that, but a couple other things are going on here. Namely, with this deal and the other moves they've made in Boston with putting the E190s on LaGuardia Boston shuttle route, is the LaGuardia and Boston crew bases will be closing. U.S. Airways is closing Vegas as well as a crew base, but I guess for USAPA, because technically they only represent the East pilots, that's LaGuardia and Boston are a bigger issue for them. So obviously the crews aren't happy about that, and they're obviously concerned about the profitability of the airline, and they think that this might be a bad move by management. But at the same time, I don't know why they didn't say, we don't like that our crew bases are closing in the press release, because phrases like higher airfares and this deal is going to make result in a loss of service in small communities, those are phrases that are just tailor-made for politicians for their ears to perk up. And I'm not sure what's going to happen with fares, but I mean, Delta's committed to really start service in all these markets that U.S. Airways is dropping. So, I mean, the government's going to have to do its job anyway. They have to analyze this deal and see if it can go through. Personally, I think it's a good deal. Granted, yes, U.S. Airways is getting less slots than Delta, but the fact is that regional jets aren't as profitable as they used to be, and that's that. So I still think it's a good deal.
Well, Dan, what's in it for the airline pilots? I mean, what's the final end game with the lawsuit to prevent it from going through?
I don't think they want to go through. I don't think they're suing them at this point. The U.S. Airways pilots are busy suing each other, but right now this is just a letter sent over. So, but the other thing is, they're not losing out. The mainline pilots aren't losing out a lot, because LaGuardia does not have a huge amount of mainline service. It's really U.S. Airways Express losing a lot. That's getting cut a lot. And I think about 300 employees that work for the U.S. Airways subsidiary Piedmont are going to be losing their jobs. And that's one reason why I think it's more we're angry about the crew base, because there's I believe there will be some loss in mainline flying, but Express is going to get hit the most. If this deal goes through as management hopes, with the, okay, we get out LaGuardia, we get to build up Reagan, we get some new international flights, I mean, if that helps bring U.S. Airways to profitability, obviously that's good for everyone. I think there are some other motives behind this announcement, with the closing of the crew bases and contract negotiations and other things. So that's just my thoughts on it.
Okay, good. Next we have from the Times Online. This is Bertrand Piccard's solar impulse aircraft makes inaugural flight. Now, we like to cover green aviation from time to time when things come up, and this is kind of a milestone event in some ways. This is about the solar impulse. This is an aircraft that's designed to fly using four solar-driven electric propellers, and this thing has made a short flight, just 1,100 feet, about 350 meters, and only a meter above the runway. But it's sort of the initial flight. This aircraft was designed really to fly indefinitely. Many other solar-powered or electric, let's say, aircraft have relied on batteries, which have to be charged, and the aircraft can fly until the batteries run out. This has solar panels on it, and the idea is that during the daytime, during the daylight hours, that the solar panels would create the electricity to both power the aircraft but also charge batteries, so that this thing could actually fly during the night and could then become an aircraft that could fly indefinitely. This is a manned version of that, obviously, and they're planning on a sort of around-the-world flight of this thing eventually, where they would actually use, you know, a series of pilots, so the thing would fly for a period of time, then come down and get a new human being to take it back up and keep going. So it's a fairly ambitious project.
I know nothing about this, but it sounds cool.
But NASA had that. It's at the Smithsonian Udarhazy. They had a solar powered aircraft that was
the Pathfinder.
The solar Pathfinder. That looks a lot.
Yes, it does.
I will say that the Times article could have gotten a better picture than a fisheye lens of this aircraft. It sort of looks like a rainbow in this photograph, but I digress. So solar flight isn't that unusual. I guess the fact that this is a manned solar flight,
right,
would be the difference. And I think basically it sounds like a lot of nothing for what I guess the article quoted 80 million pounds for this project. So what do we get? We get a solar airplane that can fly around the world, and I guess the technology will be moved into other things. You're the aeronautical engineering, Max. Do you think there's any uses for this going forward in the future, except for maybe reconnaissance aircraft?
Well, there's certainly that, but I think it's also a technology demonstrator kind of event. The path from this with a one man crew or maybe two man, I'm not sure, you know, to something that's commercially viable or a military application is you know, it's a long path. But it does continue in the vein of what NASA had done with the Pathfinder, and which grew into the Centurion, which grew into the Helios. And there is a pretty strong physical resemblance in that, you know, you've got multiple engines and you've got this you know, very long wingspan. The NASA effort really occurred over, you know, a number of different years and fits and starts, and finished when the Helios version of this thing encountered some weather that I guess kind of caused it to flex into a kind of a U-shape, at which point that there was structural failure and the thing fell into the ocean. But there hasn't been anything since then. But it is worth watching. You know, I don't know if the technology from the solar panels is enough to, you know, generate enough, you know, energy to carry any significant payload.
They also have a really good website about it, solarimpulse.com. I just, in the meantime, just checked it out, and it looks impressive. Big wings.
All right, moving into the military arena, we had some interesting developments last week. This is from Aviation Week. Northrop rejects tanker bid under draft RFP. This is the continuing saga of the Air Force tanker program, and what's happened is that Northrop Grumman has told the Pentagon that they will not bid for the replacement tanker under the existing request for proposal. It seems that the format, or at least the mathematics of the RFP, have changed from previous iterations, and the Air Force RFP includes 373 pass-fail requirements. You either pass it or you fail it. You either make it or you don't. And there's apparently no weighting of the requirements. So you could have, in this article, points out an example, one of the requirements, and I don't know if this is an actual requirement or just an example, but they say, you know, the water flow in the sinks might be a requirement, and so could fuel offload rates. And under the RFP, both are weighted equally. And Northrop Grumman, I think, is saying that's not right. Certainly some things are more important than others.
There are a couple other things here, too. Flight Global had a really good article by Stephen Trimble, who's, I think, one of the best reporters out there. He wrote, in October, Northrop officials complained that the competition was unfair. The U.S. Air Force had decided to make the existing KC-135R tanker's performance the benchmark for winning the contract. Northrop's A330-based KC-45 tankers large and Boeing's potential KC-767, so that's one issue. The other issue, he wrote, the letter also criticizes a contract structure that, quote, places contractual and financial burdens on the company that we simply cannot accept, end quote. And Trimble writes, the Pentagon has adopted a fixed price structure for the contract, meaning the bidders must accept the financial risk of cost overruns. The evaluation is also tilted towards the lowest price bidder, which Northrop previously complained will result in a, quote, race to the bottom. So, I mean, this saga is always fun to watch. It's one of aviation's greatest soap operas, I think.
It's pretty entertaining.
But
but what's Northrop doing? I mean, this is, you know, they're basically saying, okay, forget it. I'm going to take my ball and go home. And that's kind of a risky move. I mean, either they really intend to bow out, which I just find incredible, or, you know, they're playing, you know, they're playing the game. They're saying, you know, okay, this is what we're going to do. Now, what are you going to do?
It's like what we said before. It and I said this a couple episodes ago. This is going to be how to sue yourself into a contract with the Pentagon.
Yeah.
This is real, in my opinion, not real unsurprising that Northrop was going to say, oh, it's unfair this time, like Boeing did last time. Oh, it's unfair this time. It favors the... And I don't... Yeah, I guess the fact that if the toilet flushes at the wrong rate, it shouldn't weigh as heavily as fuel offflow into the aircraft that's right. fueling, but it seems to me that I think Dan's right in the article Dan just pointed out to. I think what Northrop's worried about is the cost overruns and the fact that they're held accountable for anything that's over their bid. I know the Australian A330s that they're using to refuel are having all sorts of problems and they're not up to snuff yet. So I'm afraid they're afraid that they're going to be hit with a lot of money that they might not afford because of that cash overrun. Dan, do you agree?
I think it might be part of the cost overruns, but I think Northrop knows what they're doing. I'm sure they still want this contract, but making these threats is always good. And in both cases, both Boeing and Northrop have their own. They're great at lobbying, and they both have their supporters in Congress. Obviously, Washington versus Alabama. So I think they just wanted to try to make some changes. I think the government might, you know, they'll probably make a couple changes to make Northrop happy. I really doubt the federal government let Northrop walk away from the table because they want some kind of competition for this thing.
The only way any of this makes sense to me is if the underlying strategy is that, you know, given these economic times, you know, we really can't afford this right now anyway. So, you know, if it's deferred, it's better for the country, you know, make do with the tankers that we have now, but it's just too ridiculous.
Yeah, Max, no. there's no way we can exist anymore on KC-135s and KC-10s when you've got aircraft older than the grandkids that are piloting them. Yeah, I know we're going to be flying B-52s till 2050 or whatever the last estimate was, but the tankers, that's hard duty. I mean, it's the difference between your Ferrari sports car or that Ford F-150. The KC-135s are the Ford F-150s. They're getting used every day because everybody needs gas, and we need this tanker program years ago, and I just can't understand how. Actually, we're coming up on the anniversary of the KC-10 winning its tanker program, which is next week, back in the 70s, and that went through flawlessly. And I went in, we saw what we wanted, we purchased them, and got it done. I don't know why this is like pulling teeth anymore.
I think the big issue is it's based on an A330. So you clearly have some protectionist sentiment some places, but obviously Boeing doesn't want to lose this contract. Obviously the Alabama representatives in the House and the Senate, they clearly want this would be great for their manufacturing base. So I think it's just these politics that are really affecting it that much.
Our guest this episode is James Patton. Jim is a lifelong test pilot. He's been a naval aviator an FAA test pilot and chief test pilot and head of flight ops at NASA's Langley Research Center. He's fairly proficient at spin testing, it seems, and Jim was recently inducted into the Virginia Aviation Hall of Fame. Jim, it's a real pleasure to have you join us today.
Thank you.
So you have been a test pilot for almost as long as you've been in aviation, it seems like. Is that right?
It does seem like, but not quite. I began flying in high school at the age of 15, taking flying lessons, and soloed in 1945. At the age of, I guess that was 17.
Wow. Starting at a pretty young age. Was there something that sort of sparked your interest in flying?
You know, this is strange. Strange because I had no direct connections to flying. I was simply fascinated with airplanes from earliest time of memory.
Okay.
My mother said that before I could talk, I used to point and say, goo-goo, boo. Mothers can understand things, others can't.
Of course.
She thought that I said, I want to fly that airplane. But I did. I was crazy about airplanes from day one. I don't know why, but I was. In high school, I drew sketches of airplanes, what else? And it just went on from there. And finally, at the age of 15, I began taking flying lessons. I have to give my parents a lot of credit because they were leery of airplanes. Those flying machines.
Well, sure.
But they let me do my thing, and I really admire and respect and love them for that.
What plane did you learn to fly in?
A Piper J3 Cub.
Cool.
As was true of many, many enthusiasts and wannabes, the Cub was probably instrumental in training more pilots to fly than any other airplane I could think of.
Yeah, I think
so. And that's including the military.
What happened next in your aviation career? Was it on to the Navy?
When I was turning 18, I was flying Piper Cubs and other little airplanes. I received a notice from the U.S. draft that I was due for a pre-induction physical. So that seemed to be the way I was going. And then about that time, I heard somewhere, I don't remember where, that the Navy flight program was just opening up. All of the military programs had been closed down, flight programs, that is.
Mm-hmm.
So I dashed down to Houston and took the 3-day physical and mental exam and passed. So I squeaked under the door there and evaded the draft and got into the Navy flight program. And that involved college. So I went to college for 2 years. After that, on to flight training in 1946, I guess it was, yeah.
And what were you flying in the Navy?
The Navy had just, in a very prescient move, I think, it ceased using the N2S, the Stearman, the Yellow Peril, the biplane.
Yeah, right.
And began basic flight, primary and basic flight training in the SNJ, a beautiful T-6 in Air Force parlance.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful two-seat airplane with a 550 horsepower engine and hydraulic system, retractable landing gear, and constant speed prop, and quite an advanced airplane from what the N2S Stearman had been. But that was nothing compared to this wonderful new airplane in the Navy. That was in 1948.
Okay.
That I began primary flight training in the SNJ.
So when did you sort of delve into the realm of being a test pilot? What was the path that led you to that?
Just getting into Navy flight training was so far beyond my wildest dreams that I was living this dream. I couldn't have thought about being a test pilot. That was, you know, that was stuff that was back of the Life magazine pages where the guys with Camel cigarettes in their mouth and their lips were...
Something to dream of, I guess.
I didn't think about being a test pilot. That was so far beyond my wildest dreams. But I was so engrossed in becoming a naval aviator that that was my highest ambition at that point. I eventually succeeded in doing that and getting through Navy flight training.
Well, so how long were you flying with the Navy?
Before I got my wings, I finished basic training by landing 6 times on an aircraft carrier out of Pensacola. I was in an SNJ. And then I was assigned, against my real wishes, into TBMs, a torpedo bomber. Went to Corpus Christi and went through training in that and got my wing after another 7 carrier landings in the TBM. And then I was assigned to the East Coast Navy, flying TBMs in an anti-submarine squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And did that for about six months, and our mission was then changed to Night Attack and AD, now called A-1, Skyraider airplanes. At that very point, the Korean War started, and I was supposed to have been released to an active duty, really against my wishes. But because of the Korean War, I was kept in and went back to this new assignment, and my squadron, which was then transferred to Atlantic City, New Jersey, and flew for another couple of years as a Night Attack squadron pilot, flying at night and in bad weather off carriers in the Skyraider airplane. Wonderful airplane.
How was that to fly, Jim?
It was beautiful. It was my first experience with an airplane with nicely balanced control. That is, the ailerons and the elevator forces were very nicely harmonized. The aileron forces were supplemented by hydraulic boosters, and it was just a lovely airplane to fly. It had a bubble canopy, tremendous reserves of power. It was just a lovely airplane. And flying off the carrier was wonderful. It's the best flying I ever did, really. I loved carrier flying. And then after a couple of years of that, I went down to Kingsville, Texas, NAS Kingsville, instructed for a year and a half, back to TBM. And then at that point, I elected to go to an active duty and went back to college. So I went back to school, and I didn't want to leave flying. And the best way I could think of to stay around was to take a major in aeronautical engineering. So I did that at the University of Colorado and graduated in 1956, during which time I got married to the sister of a guy I went through flight training with. We used to, certainly I forget our weddings, we would travel to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania to visit his parents.
Right.
His kid sister. 17 at the time, and therefore inviolate, untouchable, was cute. And he warned her, don't fool around with Jim. He's a party boy. But we eventually did that and got married five years later.
Yeah, that's great.
And 55 years later, she's still my wife.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It has been, really.
So you're coming out of school now.
Yeah. So both my wife's parents and my parents were kind of leery of my flying.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a job with Chance Vaught as a flight test engineer and did that for 2 years.
Okay.
But without flying, I kind of cheated. I kept flying in the Navy Reserve on weekends.
Oh, perfect.
I was flying jets by that time.
Jim, when you were in the Naval Reserve, were you flying Panthers?
Oh, I flew Cougars and one after the Panther. And I flew the FJ-3.
How was the FJ-3 to fly?
Oh, it was a lovely airplane. I loved it. It's a great airplane. The Cougar was a Grumman product, so it was just solid, faithful, steady, and all that. But it was a little bit not as much fun as the FJ-3. After 2 years of being a flight test engineer, there was a hole in my life, and I really wanted to go back to flying. And I then heard through a mutual friend that the CAA, now the FAA,
right,
had an opening for a flight test pilot in Fort Worth, Texas. And so I went and applied for that.
Sure.
And they took me on. And shortly after that, within a year, they sent me to Navy Test Pilot School. Fantastic. I had no idea, nor did they, that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
The General Elwood Quesada, who took over the FAA at its inception, waited in there using his machete, and the civil servants were quivering, the old bureaucratic types, and he said, why aren't we using the test pilot schools, the military ones, you know? So immediately, twitches went out to all the regional offices. Who can go to test pilot school? Well, I was jumping up and down with my hands.
There you go. So I said, yeah.
Take me.
Yeah.
So they did, and I went through Navy test pilot school, got out in 1960. After an eight-month wonderful course, wonderful because it was very challenging, one of those things that you wouldn't take for anything, which you wouldn't jump to do again.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough, but fun. And then I came back to the FAA and did the Lockheed Jetstar. It was one of the first things I did after I got back as a certification flight testing. And then the supersonic transport was coming along in the early 60s. And that was seemed to be a real challenge. And my gosh, what red-blooded boy wouldn't want to be on tap to do some flight testing in that airplane?
Sure.
So I applied and was accepted as the SST development project and followed that for 2 years. And finally, that foundered and went down the tubes. The Concorde was successful because it didn't take as big a bite, didn't try to take as big a bite as the U.S. SST. They tried for too much, and it failed because of that.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Boeing and Lockheed and North American all vied for that job, but the FAA had specified Mach 2.7, and that was simply too big a bite. The Concorde settled for Mach 2.0, and that was okay because aluminum could withstand that, but it couldn't go to 2.7. That the temperature rise was just too high, and so they had to use titanium. And it was a very new material. It simply wasn't the time. And about that time, NASA Langley Research Center had an opening. And I'd been working with NASA people, pilots and engineers, on the SST development program. They helped by, I think, recommending me to Jack Reeder, chief of operations at NASA Langley. Jack was a world-class test pilot, especially in and vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, helicopters and so forth, but others also. So he hired me. That was in 1966. Good to go back a little bit. During my FAA experiences, I encountered two light airplanes, popular light airplanes, the Mooney and the Cherokee, Piper Cherokee, that had unrecoverable flat spins if you put, you know, stuck a stick in their ear. And I was very impressed by that. I had to use a spin recovery parachute in each case to get out of it, but it left its impression because they simply didn't have the tools, the design tools in those days, to design airplanes that would be good spin recovery airplanes.
Right.
So as soon as I got to NASA in 1966, I began writing proposed programs for spin research. And after a couple of years, finally, with the added impetus of NTSB and FAA, please, NASA Langley finally said, okay, well, all right, reluctantly gave the go-ahead. So that began the spin recovery program. That was in 1973. The program went on for about 14 years and came to include four general aviation-type airplanes. It was a Piper T-tail, an American Aviation Yankee, a Cessna 172, and a Beechcraft C-23, all modified heavily because litigation was a real problem in those days. And we were very aware that if we did the testing of production airplanes and bad spins were encountered, that litigation would probably result. And that all worked out. We didn't have any lawsuits over that 14-year period. I estimate I did 8,000 spin turns, and Phil Brown, the other NASA pilot that came into the program with me, probably did 4,000.
Now, let me ask you, Jim, was the objective of the program to try to understand the dynamics of spins so that could be incorporated into the aircraft?
Yeah, because we couldn't do anything about the thing until we understood it.
Right. And there was no computer modeling to guide the way at those days.
We really welcomed getting the Yankee as our first spin airplane because it had flat spins. It was known to have flat spins. People had been killed in it. And so that was great because we need to see both ends of the stick before we could really do much. And so we did learn during the program a lot. Learned a lot. We learned that, for one thing, the wing is usually the primary driver in determining the kind of spin, the extreme kind of spin you're going to get, either good or bad. And we learned how to make any of the test airplanes that we had, from the 172 to all of them. We learned how to make them spin flat and non-recoverable, or how to make them spin like a kiddie car, just by changing the wing profile, particularly the leading edge. It was a very good program.
Flat spins are more comfortable than steep spins because rolling maneuvers are more disruptive of balance than flat spins.
What was the toughest airplane you ever had to spin? Did you ever have one that you couldn't get into a spin?
Oh, yeah. We had situations where we tried and tried and tried to get the bad spins. And it was on the day that we finally got the airplane to spin flat and unrecoverable, we had a great little party that night because that proved that the spin tunnel at Langley had been right. It predicted that we would, with this particular tail configuration, get into a flat spin. But it took us a while to learn how to do it. We did it by control sequencing. At the same time that I'm experiencing this, Grumman American was doing spin testing down at Savannah, Georgia, and they found that pushing the stick forward, which is known to be, you know, to be aggressive in spins, would make the airplane spin faster. And if you kept it forward long enough, it would spin up flat. It would spin faster and faster, then flatten out and become non-recoverable. So then we, in our Yaki, began doing, it was a different, slightly different configuration. So we began doing the same kind of thing, and we found that by pushing the stick forward for a couple of turns and accelerating the yaw rate and then bringing the stick back, would swap off that increased yaw rate for roll rate for yaw rate.
Tell us about your the Vertol career that you had. You actually have a rotor career besides fixed wing, and I also know that you were in a lot of the Vertol testing, like the Dornier DO-31. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The first experience I had with VTOL, I guess that was a XC-142 probably, and that was a tilt wing. Chance Vaught and Hiller and Ryan coordinated to build the XC-142 for DOD. And it was a design wherein the wing was raised, had four turboprop engines. The wing was raised rather than rotors. And once the wing was raised, then you had the four propellers acting as rotors with a balancing tail propeller to provide pitch control. And we got that in Langley and used it for a year and a half. And that was the first one. Preparing for the Dornier DO-31, another airplane we had at Langley was the Hawker P-1127, which was the forerunner of the Harrier jump jet.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, you know, the Harrier was the same thing as the Harrier with the smaller engine and didn't have the capability to do a full gross weight takeoff, but it could do hover landings after you burn down some fuel. I flew that several times to prepare for a project over in Germany, the Dornier DO-31, which had 10 jet engines to comprise a vertical takeoff and landing transport, 45,000-pound airplane.
Did you say 10 engines?
Yes.
Wow.
In each wingtip, there were four RB-162, 1,000-pound jet engines.
Yeah, wow.
And under the wings was an engine such as what was in the Harrier or the P-1127 with swiveling nozzles, which were capable of providing forward thrust and with a nozzle swiveling vertical thrust. And then for balancing, used a bleed air from the engines, underwing engines, to provide pitch and roll control. And
how did that fly in level flight, Jim?
Oh, it was great. Nice flying airplane. It was also very good in transition and hover. But the kind of a drawback was it was a single-string system. That is, the stabilization system, which was mandatory control when jet-borne flight, was single channel, and a single failure could land you in deep yogurt, I mean, immediately. So we had Martin Baker seats, ejection seats, and there were just two pilots, no other people. And if you did lose that system, you'd have to eject immediately. So it was an interesting plane. That it kept your attention, focused your attention, you might say.
Jim, let me ask you a question, because I'm listening to this, and this is fascinating, and I'm wondering, what's the difference between a test pilot and just your average run-of-the-mill pilot? I mean, is a test pilot exactly the same thing, or is a test pilot the same thing but a little crazy?
Oh, it's very simple. I think to do anything, especially training is required.
Right.
So that's the difference. You train for it. For instance, I'm an aeronautical engineer. I think that's a requirement these days. I know it.
Right.
and went to Navy Test Pilot School. And that's highly desirable, not mandatory. OJT is okay, and that's done often because the military test schools can only turn out so many people.
Uh-huh.
On-the-job training is certainly acceptable. Beyond that, I think you're talking about personalities, perhaps, or the simply interests. I think to be a test pilot, one that should be curious, very curious, wanting to know why for everything.
Right.
Not willing to just take a word, go and do it, and don't ask why.
Is it a little like being a detective in a way?
Well, sure. I think so, probably. I think curiosity is probably a good thing. I really haven't thought about that a lot, but I think that one has to be willing to pursue. I think that determination is important. You know, just pursue a thing to a certain point and then drop it. I think you want to find out why. And once you've taken on something, you need to finish it. There have been times when I found out bad things. When the airplane really surprised me, but you can't just turn away and walk away. Then you have to find out why. What is this thing doing and why? And
right, exactly.
Solve it.
Okay. Listen, we're starting to run a little bit long, and so we want to make sure that we leave time for a little game that we play with most of our guests. Jim,
yeah.
This is called word association, and it's very simple. We'll say a word or a phrase. And then you just start talking about the first thing that pops into your head.
All right.
Okay, and I think David will start.
All right.
Jim, how about the word hover?
Oh, I think helicopters, VTOLs, working hard.
What do you mean by working hard?
The system, the whole system of flying, it changes between hover and up and away flight. In hover, you're talking about acceleration commands. And up and away flight, you're talking about rate command. They're quite different. Acceleration command means that here you are hovering, let's say in a helicopter, whatever, and you tilt the vector that's supporting you. Then you begin accelerating. And the method of flying is that once you do that, you immediately check it. You come back and put in opposite controls so that you are in control of what you are doing. If you don't do that, then it being acceleration command, you will continue accelerating in that direction. And that's quite different. That's what you have to learn to hover a helicopter versus flying an airplane.
Okay, very good. That's interesting. I'll go next. And mine is kind of a phrase rather than a word. And Jim, when I say this, what do you think of? Worst idea for an airplane.
Oh, I had a terrible little airplane. I tried to certify. I did certify it when I was in FAA. It was the first airplane I'd ever seen that when I first flew it. It was unstable, roll and pitch. I worked with them and we finally got it back where it was barely acceptable. It was terrible. Thank God it wasn't ever certificated. We fixed it up enough so it was barely acceptable before it was certificated. But thank God it never was produced.
Does that happen very often? I mean, are there, do you think, many designs that just don't make it?
Well, I think usually by the time that I ever got to see an airplane while in the FAA or in the military, it was pretty good. Now, there were exceptions to that. In the VTOL field, there was a little airplane called the Hummingbird, but got by Lockheed. It was one of the early, it was one of the many attempts at VTOL that was paid for by DOD. That was just very, very marginal, and I'm thankful I didn't get to fly it. The pilot who was flying it was killed, and so I didn't,
oh,
I didn't
dear.
Fly it. But it was one of those ideas that was like a flying shoebox, and it had a jet engine, and the doors open on top, and below the engine, plenum exhaust, many, many little nozzles exhausting downward. And the idea was it was going to entrain ambient air, and that was going to multiply the thrust.
Okay.
Didn't work. It was just barely there. It could barely get airborne. And it was squirrely as hell, of course. So.
All right. David, did you have another one?
Oh, yeah. One last one, James. T-38.
I loved it.
What's it like to fly?
Oh, very nice. It was demanding because it was fast and because it only had a certain amount of fuel. And you had to plan your flight carefully, and then fly the plan. But it was good for that because of that, because as a proficiency trainer, which is what we used it for, it was just wonderful. Didn't have an autopilot. You had to fly it. And up at 40,000, it was just barely stable, so you had to work at it. Or not work at it, but you couldn't relax and goof off. But I loved the airplane. I flew it for 1,100 hours, a little over. And as I say, we used it at Langley for proficiency, and I flew it on many, many cross countries, and I was very fond of it. I liked it. It was great as long as you were there ahead of it.
Okay, well, Jim, I think we could probably talk all night, but we're going to
have to... It's fun to bore. We can talk for 2 nights.
So we want to thank you for joining us, and also congratulations on your induction into the Virginia Aviation Hall of Fame. Was that a terrific event for you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. The family was all there. That was one of the great things about it. All three girls and both grandsons and my sister from Austin, Texas. So we had a great visit.
Fantastic. Must have been a proud moment.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Okay. Well, thank you for interviewing me.
Our pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
You bet.
And now with This Week in Aviation, it's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. On December 6, 1941, the New York City Council agrees to build a supplemental airfield in the borough of Queens, designed to alleviate some of the traffic from the already overflowing LaGuardia. The authorization allowed the purchase of 1,000 acres of the Idlewild Golf Course, located on the southern side of Long Island. This would eventually become John F. Kennedy International Airport. December 7, 1944, the International Civil Aviation Conference wraps up in Chicago. 54 nations were at the original conference, which began on November 1, 1944. Two aviation freedoms were approved. One, the right to fly over another nation without the necessity of landing. And number two, the right to land or to take fuel or to make repairs without boarding or deplaning. December 7, 1980. The Pan Am 747 SP-21, November 54A Papa Alpha, China Clipper leaves JFK for a flight to Beijing, China. The flight stopped at Tokyo's Haneda, then flew on to Beijing. The flight marked the first commercial flight from a U.S. to China in 31 years. The U.S. had stopped flights due to the ending of relations after the Chinese Revolution. On December 9, 1919, Dr. Henry W. Walden of Long Island pilots his Walden 9. The Walden 9 is the first monoplane flown in the United States. Walden was a dentist by trade, and dentistry paid for his hobby. It left him quite broke. He was a true airplane geek. December 10, 1958, National Airlines begins the first domestic jet service between Idlewild and Miami International Airport. The flight used a leased 707 from Pan Am. I couldn't find the November number. Sorry to disappoint you guys. And on December 12, 1951, an Alaskan Airlines DC-4B makes the first commercial flight over the North Pole. The flight was uneventful except for the crew seeing a bogey on the radar. The red UFO intercepted the flight, then returned from whence it came. Evidently, the sound of four radios do not disturb reindeer. Finally, first flights had occurred during the week of December 6th through December 12th. This week has been brought to you by the Bell Corporation. The Bell Model 24, otherwise known as the P-63 King Cobra, flew on December 7th, 1942. The Bell 47, the OH-13 Sioux, flew on December 8th, 1945. Did I say December 7th, 1942? Hmm. Bell 206, OH-58 Jet Ranger, otherwise known as the Kiowa, flies on December 8, 1962. The Bell AH-1Z Viper, the new twin-engine, four-rotored AH-1W Cobra, flew on December 8, 2000. And lastly, the Bell 427 Super Jet Ranger flew on December 11, 1997. If anyone knows why Bell is so fond of this week, and in the eighth in particular, please let the author know.
Yeah, that's incredible.
It must be their lucky week or something. And so that's the way it was, December 6th through December 12th. I'd like to give a shout out to, I slightly avoided December 7th, 1941. There was 400 aircraft that took part in the attack on Pearl Harbor, but that's for another story. I also would like to shout out to the more important holiday on December 7th in this household, which is, it's my wife's birthday. So happy birthday, hon.
Brownie points for David.
So that's the way it was, folks. December 6th through December 12th, this is David M. Vanderhoof signing off.
Great. Hey, thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Steve and Grant went on a road trip and did the recording for this week's Australia Desk from the Plain Crazy Down Under mobile recording studio, which is the same thing as Steve's car. Here it is. On the road again.
Just can't wait to get on the road again. Dateline, December 12th, 2009.
Well, g'day folks, it's Stephen Grant here, and Grant, we're sitting on the Goulburn Valley Highway. Doing 110 kilometres an hour. We're on the road doing the Australia Desk report this week.
That's right, on the road again. Oh, probably should cut that.
No singing, mate.
Yeah, we're on the road heading south back to Melbourne after a great weekend hanging out up north, enjoying some really good country hospitality. We headed up north to go to the Pip Borman Memorial Tribute Dinner. Matt Hall from Matt Hall Racing was there. Oh, sorry. Our good friend, Matt Hall.
Yes, he's never met us.
Yeah, we got to meet Matt Hall as part of the Show Us Your Wheels dinner. Show Us Your Wheels is an all-day car rally held in Numurkah, just north of Shepparton in rural Victoria, celebrating all good things vehicular on the ground, but with a bit of an air show as well. Matt was in town to do the aerobatics display that Pip Borman used to do. So the dinner on the Saturday night beforehand was in Pip's memory. It was the first Show Us Your Wheels that Pip wasn't actually at to do his air show. So Matt had come over. He'd come down from Newcastle, north of Sydney. And we had a really good dinner and a couple of great speeches. We recorded the lot, and that'll come out on a near future PCDU episode. But,
yeah, it was a really fascinating speech, and it got quite emotional at times. Of course, Pip Borman was a very, very well-known aerobatic pilot in this country and sadly lost his life in an aircraft accident earlier this year in February. And so this was really a tribute night to him. And yeah, Grant was quite emotional at times for some of the speakers.
Big tragedy. Pip was getting it was known as the Samson, a very high-powered biplane, muscle plane aerobatics aircraft. He was getting that ready for Avalon Air Show, and they were doing a photo shoot, and the engine quit on him, and he was at low level and couldn't pull out, and unfortunately augured in, and not pretty at all. But yeah, so in memory of Pip, we were all gathered. It was a wonderful evening, if a little emotional. And then the next day, the Sunday was supposed to be the Show Us Your Wheels show. We took a look from the outside, decided we'd go and hang out at nearby Shepparton Airport, where we're pretty sure Matt had the aircraft based, and we were made very welcome by the locals at the airport, and we hung out there all day and just talked flying, looked at aircraft, ran into a few old friends, and had a really good time chatting with Matt and also with Jim and Jenny Wickham. Jim was flying his three-quarter scale P-51 and also doing a handling demo with a Robinson R-22, so it was a great time to hang out at the airport. Matt did an impromptu warm-up aerobatics session before he went over to Numurkah, and then a little victory one when he came back, so we got to see some amazing flying today.
Spectacular stuff, mate. So, yeah, this is a bit of an experiment recording this on the road. We hope you can hear it, Grant, but let's hit a couple of news stories while we're driving.
Yeah, so Steve's driving, so he's paying attention to the road, and we're going to have a quick discussion on a couple of stories. Now, first one off the bat is that our fearless leader, the illustrious Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, As, no, no, we're not going into politics or there'll be a car accident. Kevin's Boeing 737, the BBJ. The RAAF flies a couple of Boeing BBJs in VIP configuration. Kevin Rudd was over in the USA for a day or two to meet up with Obama and talk about everything going on in the world. And on the way out, they had a mechanical problem with the BBJ and had to stop over in Edwards, I believe it was. They stopped over at Edwards Air Force Base. They got that sorted out, and then they were flying out again, and apparently it went US again, and they landed it at Honolulu.
Yes,
and
field.
Yeah, and I was being told that the official word was they were just stopping off for a bit of fueling, but according to a couple of staffers, they actually they did have a mechanical fault with the planes. That's two mechanical faults very close beside each other, so I'm not sure what was going on with that BBJ. It would be very interested if we find out. We'll let you know.
Yeah, these Boeing... the 737-700 series, obviously modified in the BBJ configuration there. We're not sure the military equivalent in the US. We're not sure what the designation would be for the 737, but those aircraft were purchased by our previous administration to replace a fleet of very aging Boeing 707s, which were very unreliable and in fact were so noisy with their old style engines that they were not permitted to land at many airports around the world. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens with these aircraft and what the problem was. Obviously it wasn't anything too major, but yeah, this is one of the main reasons that these aircraft were purchased, so that we wouldn't have these reliability factors. Mind you, our Prime Minister makes a habit of flying the wings off these things. He's uses them a lot more than the previous one did, so it's probably any wonder that they're having a bit higher maintenance these days.
Yeah, indeed. And these aircraft are kitted out in either 36 passengers or in the super VIP configuration with boardroom tables. They're kitted out for 30 passengers, so that's a lot of aircraft for only 30 people, but not unsurprising when you're talking super VIP scenarios. But moving along, the next item we've got is our favourite friend's tiger.
Meow!
Oh, I wish we had our sound effects. Yeah, I think so. We definitely need our sound effects rig here in the car. But our friends at Tiger, the rumour is that they're about to launch a public float of the company, either a full or partial float. They're looking at getting, I believe it's $500 million, rather, to fund some additional aircraft purchases and expansion. They haven't got full confirmation of that one just as yet, but that's the word going around. No doubt if it's true, they'll be watching very closely as SkyWest, one of our regional airlines here, they're going and doing a public float this week and getting some money for the same kind of thing, a bit of expansion, stabilisation, and also looking to do some international routes. So SkyWest are looking to get bigger. But it'll be very interesting to see what happens with Tiger when they manage to go, if that actually does manage to come off.
Yeah, the SkyWest one is one that I find quite interesting, but looking at Tiger Airways, yeah, they definitely need to engage in this practice and raise some funds. They just don't have the infrastructure that they need to cover the nation the way they try to. So absolutely, raising more money, raising some extra capital and getting some more aircraft down here is absolutely what they need to be doing. Now, SkyWest is a far smaller airline. It predominantly operates over in Western Australia. Does a lot of charter work for the big mining companies up in the northern areas of that state. We had wondered about what might happen with those sort of aircraft with the economic downturn and obviously demand for the resources sector dropping off a little bit. But obviously they must feel that things are beginning to pick up again, and yeah, they need some more money to expand their operations, which is good news on many levels.
Indeed. So we'll keep you posted on what we hear about both these offerings. And the final piece of news is something that we probably should keep in internally to the country, because it's a bit of dirty laundry, a bit of bickering going on between the state of New South Wales, where Sydney is, and the state of Victoria, where Melbourne is. The latest dispute between the two states relates to the actual first heavier-than-air powered controlled flight in Australia. Now, according to New South Wales and the Royal Aviation Historical Society, they reckon that the first heavier-than-air controlled powered flight in Australia was on December the 9th, 1909, and it was an English gentleman who flew a Wright Model A aircraft about 150 yards at one of the race courses in Sydney. It was a straight-line flight, and it was witnessed. That was generally taken to be the first flight. However, everyone else believes that the first manned, powered, controlled, heavier-than-air flight in Australia was Harry Houdini in a biplane in Diggers Rest near Melbourne where he actually took off, stooged around, did a few orbits, circuits. Admittedly, not very high, but it was controlled and it was more than just a 150-yard hop. It was quite a significant flight. And additionally, it was witnessed by the official aviation body, you might say. So New South Wales are going ahead and celebrating their centenary in 1909, but the rest of us are going to do it next year in March 18th, 2010.
Yeah, so maybe, David, that's something you could find out for us, seeing as you know far more about our history than than we do. And we're not sure. We're trying to find out. And, yeah, David, if you can help us find out, yeah, well, that'll make us all the more wiser.
Yeah, there's definitely rivalry, as you may have heard. It's definitely still lingering between Victoria and New South Wales, just on our introduction there.
Absolutely, folks. Well, we better wrap it up there, Grant. I just looking at some stats on the old ground speed monitoring device here. We've covered nearly 20 kilometres in that report. I'm not sure how many gallons that would be in that imperial measurement system they use over there. And we only hit 3 pedestrians, so really I think this was quite a successful experiment.
Yeah, I think it was pretty good. There was a little bit of roadkill, a couple of hares, a wombat. It did bounce that kangaroo off us, but it was the surprised look on the lady's face as we went over the top of her. But yeah, I'll treasure that always.
She was only a police officer, so we're not too worried.
There you go, folks. And before we get more in trouble than it's possible, we'll take our contentious selves and focus once again on driving back to Melbourne. Thanks, everyone. Appreciate your time.
Cheers, folks.
So, David, do you think you're going to be able to offer any assistance with the question as to what the first heavier-than-air-powered controlled flight in Australia was?
Yeah, it was December 17th, 1903, by Orville Wright. Then you don't, if you take that one as the first heavier-than-air flight and forget that it occurred in the United States, then we won't have an argument. What I really want to know is,
yeah,
how do you drive and hold a tape recorder at the same time?
Well, that's what Grant, Steve was driving, and Grant had the recorder.
Well, I have to commend them for their effort.
Yeah, good effort. Yeah, they came through. Thanks to Steve and Grant. We received some listener email and one voicemail actually from Stephen. He left a message on our listener line.
Hi guys, this is Steven from California, just listening to your podcast while driving to work. And I had to stop quick and pause the podcast because you just mentioned a app for the iPhone and any ideas for it. And one idea I have is maybe an app that would have aviation history quiz. Maybe between the help of David Vanderhoof and Dan, and maybe some, you know, that way you get some airline and historical, you know, maybe military stuff with David, and then could also do some maybe turbine or engine quizzes with from Max, and then maybe some GA stuff from Rob. But, yeah, I mean, that would be kind of an interesting app for the phone. It would be an aviation quiz. Maybe somehow be updated every couple months or something. All right, back to the podcast. Take care, guys.
Thanks to Steven for that. I think that's a great idea.
I think we just need to find someone to make an iPhone app for free.
We need someone who can do that. Maybe we have a listener out there that knows how to program iPhone apps.
Well, yeah, and here's what will happen. We'll sell it for like $5. And oh, yeah. I'll keep all the money, and yeah.
Yeah, that'll pay for the college tuition, right?
Yeah,
$5 a pop.
Wait. Let me calculate for a year. Hold on.
Yeah, how many iPhone apps would we have to sell?
Okay, so
at $5?
If 8,000 people buy the iPhone app, it'll pay for my tuition and room and board for a year.
All right.
I just want to know, what is it about this week that everyone's giving me homework?
Yeah.
Don't I mean, I am the only one that really writes my own segment. So I don't, folks, I'm writing for two continents and I have a day job. I'll do the best I can, but I don't think I've got time for an iPhone app.
But now you have your own new computer, so that'll help a lot with that.
Yeah, you have time to get a Mac, but not enough time to make an iPhone app. Really.
Are you volunteering there, Mr. Webb?
Not at all.
Okay. I like Steve's idea.
I can't make the podcast because I have schoolwork.
Yeah.
You know, we have had lots of comments recently, and I'm doing this on behalf of Rob, that, you know,
you need to get your priorities straight. You need to be with us on Sunday nights and not these trophy gathering cliques that you are socializing with.
No, it's not socializing. No, what, no, you want to know what happens, David? Here's my ish. It is usually there's a conflict because I like to go to mass on campus, and that is unfortunately at 8 p.m. on Sundays. So
we can't compete here, with that.
Herein lies a conflict.
That's right.
Okay, well, if you're going for a higher power than besides Rob Mark, then we understand.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I can't do it.
Okay. So,
all right, back to the listener mail. We also got a few emails, just real quick, talk about a couple that we got. One was from Damon. He was talking about this polished ice issue. We weren't able to cover it. We don't really need Rob to do that. This is about the FAA has some new requirements with regards to what they call polished ice on the wing. Damon writes in about that, and he's actually got a company that has a solution to that. And you'll figure out the solution when you hear the website, which is jetsocksinc.com. And so what Damon's company does is he produces some wing covers that go on. You put those on at night. The frost forms on the wing covers instead of on the wing. But maybe when Rob is back, it's an issue we can talk about in more detail.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
They can have some different patterns, like maybe an Argyle jet sock.
Yeah, it's sort of like wing condoms.
Okay, I didn't go that far, but okay.
Wow.
Sorry, just my mind worked.
I thought this was a family-friendly podcast.
It is. So we'll move on to Kim. Kim writes in again to explain how it can make sense in certain circumstances for an airline to reduce fares below the break-even point. Kim uses the analogy of a banana ripening at the grocery store. At some point, it goes bad and becomes worthless, so it's better to sell it before then for anything you can get, because whatever you can get will be more than the nothing that you'd get if you waited too long. And Kim's point is that airline seats can be the same thing. You can see Kim's complete email in the comments section of the airplanegeeks.com site. He's got a very interesting post. He also noted that he's actually been to Joshua's airport from 2 weeks ago. We had Josh on the show. Kim had some nice things to say about that airport, except for the crew car brakes, but otherwise... The Winchester Municipal Airport experience was a good one for Kim.
And Kim makes a good point. This is why Southwest has Ding and JetBlue does Cheaps and United does Twares. Because no matter what, the plane is going to fly and the airline has to pay for that. So
right.
A little bit of extra revenue, it would be good. Obviously, you obviously don't want people to get used to that fact and wait to book at the last minute. But yeah, I mean, that's when the revenue management geeks, which I might be in a couple of years, that's what they're there for.
All right. So that's it for this episode. We'd like to thank our guest, James Patton, again. And David, thank you for this week in aviation.
You're welcome, Max.
And always.
Rob, we missed you.
Yeah, it's not the same without Rob. We tried. Hope it's no, it can't be good enough. There's nothing as good as Rob.
Yeah, I totally missed Rob so much.
It's heartfelt, huh?
No, I'm just saying
that.
I'm not getting insulted all the time now. So.
And you sound disappointed at that, Rob.
No. That's great. But yes, we miss Rob, and you know, hopefully he will be well enough to return next week.
All right, David, tell us where people can find you online.
You can find my blog at whatjustflewby.blogspot.com, and you can always see me on Twitter at dmvanderhoof.
And Dan?
You can find my blog on Airline News at www.thingsinthesky.com. You can also find me on Twitter, Dan Webbage, and there's two B's in there. So
great.
Follow.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter as Max Flight. Visit us at airplanegeeks.com for show notes, and you can leave a comment or order an Airplane Geeks t-shirt. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter. You can send us email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com or leave a message on our listener line, and that number is 361-GEEKS-01.
Well, come on. We're not going to have Binet do that again this week?
I'll see if I can dig out Binet.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
You can subscribe to the Airplane Geeks podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace.
And Dan,
yes?
What should you do about the Airplane Geeks podcast every week?
Tell Dan how awesome he is at hosting. I'm sorry, that was pompous. Tell your friends about the podcast.
Join us next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
See you later.
Bye. Okay, what was that?
That was a woo.
That was a woo. A woo for the news.
I'm excited to be back. What do you want me to do, David?
You're showing your excitement. That's a good thing.
That's good.
Okay.
Your youthful exuberance. I'll take the role with Rob Mark this episode.
Okay, those are tough shoes to fill, but go for it.
I don't think I can be that cynical, though. No, but I have to comment. Remember, Dan. I did get accused of mispronouncing the word aviation, so I'm now on par with you.
Okay.
On December 6th, 1941, the New York City Council agrees to build a supplemental airfield in the borough of Dan, stop rattling papers.
Dan, what are you doing? Wait, well, you got to start again.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have muted my microphone.
Yeah, go ahead and mute it or something. Yeah.
I was getting a spoon.
another sound effect episode.
There we go.
The RAAF has, the RAAF, that sounded really crap.
Yeah.
Yep. The RAAF, Royal Australian Air Force, flies to, sorry, by God, on the back of a trailer just heading the other direction was a Jabiru.
Unbelievable.
With the wings off, the fuselage of a Jabiru. Oh, no, his is still being made. That's not something you expect to see on the expressway out here. So anyhow, that could be a good outtake.